and thanks for coming, and especially hello to Mary Purcell, who's come to see this event, a good and dear friend of ours. My name is Colin Grant, and I always like to start by reminding you that you've come here not to be alone, but to be in a shared space with a shared community of people who also want to be here with you. You're not at home watching television by yourself, eating your crisps. You're here at an event with other people. So what I would like you to do first of all is to turn to your neighbours on your left and your right and say, peace be with you.
Peace be with you.
Peace be with you.
Peace be with you.
Great. So I've been told to say that the sponsor of this event is Writers Mosaic. In fact, we are Writers Mosaic, so we're sponsoring ourselves. So I'll have a free glass of water. So Writers Mosaic is a magazine and a division of the Royal Literary Fund, which has been in existence since 1790. And its real mission is to help writers to continue to write. In 1790, in the early years, it was to get writers out of debtor's jail, because, spoiler alert, writers don't make any money. So the Royal Literary Fund continues to support writers both financially but also editorially. And we are the magazine that currently exists on the Royal Literary Fund. And one of the key projects we have, and it's been a collaboration with Penguin Random House, the publisher Jonathan Cape, we brought out a collection podcast called What We Leave We Carry, which is also the title of the book. And What We Leave We Carry is a phrase, stanza from a poem by a poet called John LaRose. The poem is called Not From Here. And to my mind, I'm nominally the author, but in fact, I'm a kind of co-curator of the book. To my mind, What We Leave We Carry is a lovely phrase because it refers to the idea of what do you leave behind when you leave your country of origin, and what do you bring with you both physically and emotionally when you come to Britain. And all the people on this stage with me have been migrants at some stage of their lives to Britain and are included in the book. And what I learned early on when I had this commission 3 or 4 years ago was that I couldn't do it without other people's help, because we've done 70 interviews around the country of migrants to this country, asking them why they came and what their experience of being a migrant has been and how they feel they might become British. And so I'd like to welcome firstly Amanda Villanova.
Hello.
Eric and Gail Charles.
Hiya.
Suzanne Harrington. For the book, but also for parts of Writers Mosaic, there are certain themes that we wanted to explore. But maybe I should just start by asking you, when you got the call from Colin saying, can I interview you for this book, what were your first responses? What were your first thoughts about whether you were a migrant and wanted to identify as one?
I definitely identify as a migrant. I'm originally from Puerto Rico. And when I got the call, I was incredibly excited because there's a whole range of Latin American migration in the United Kingdom that maybe isn't seen or discussed as much as others. So I had this great opportunity to speak to friends and people I admired and first and second generation Latinos. So I thought, oh yes, I've got my Latin American ticket. Yeah, that was my response.
Thanks, you. Eric?
No, I was thinking, what aspect of my memory did you actually want and what I was comfortable in terms of sharing with an audience, you know? Did you want me to tell you the experience of growing up in Cameroon or the experience of living in Russia for the 2 years and 2 months or my experience of coming to Wales as a 64-year-old Zimbabwean? So I did not really know which aspects of my memory. But then we started talking and then I made the decision. Yeah.
And what we were able to do was to kind of craft a narrative for the podcast, and then we've extracted from those podcasts the transcriptions that relate to various themes that we have in the book. Suzanne?
I wasn't sure what you actually meant, and I thought it was about interviewing other people. So we were chatting away before I realised you were interviewing me about my experience. It was great. It's been almost 40 years since I moved from Ireland, and so it was fun to revisit things that weren't fun at the time, because you know, everything is funny eventually. it was a very exciting thing to be part of.
Well, I'm excited by the project. I'm excited to be here because my parents are Jamaican. They came from Jamaica to Britain in 1959. And I think of myself not just as the son of migrants, but a migrant still. And I have a kind of migrant sensibility. And I'm always on the lookout for migrants. And I give them the kind of migrant nod when I see them. But also in this time when there's a lot of rhetoric, which is anti-migration and insulting, in all honesty, and you lose the sight of the person because you become a block of migrants, impersonal migrants. And I think what we're attempting to do is say there are human beings here with stories. And in my mind, migrants are the most brave and fortuitous people on the planet. I really believe that. They've taken a leap of faith to come to another country, sometimes on a roll of a dice. And they come here and they want to improve their lives, not just of themselves, but of their children, but of the society in which they find themselves. When it came to the title and the themes of the book and the podcast, we wanted to address certain notions. So for instance, what do you bring with you when you're a migrant? What is the precious item that you bring with you, or idea that we bring you? And that has been answered both in the book, but also in a series of essays that Writers Mosaic does. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists what they brought with them and what that signified for them. Amanda, what about you?
I brought two items, all sort of geared by my mother's need to take care of me. And she had this idea that when you move to the United Kingdom, you have to look like a princess and impress. Which is a big part of it, I think, for a lot of people coming here. So we got a set of discounted hard pink suitcases that could roll all the way around, 360, with the idea that I'd walk through London streets looking fantastic. And then everyone would think, oh yeah, I bet she's British too. it was a really incredible day because it's such a joyous moment to purchase that with her, pack everything up and put all these things that she thought I may need as if it was going to be sub-zero here. And I couldn't possibly survive with all these mega elements. And then she sits down in bed and takes out a ring and goes, your father gave this to me, and I want you to have it. I went, why on earth would I do that? She said, well, women need insurance, and if you ever have a problem, you can sell it, and you won't always call your mum, will you? which is obviously this moment where I realized that I was gonna be very far away, and we do have whole lives that we can't share with the people that we leave behind. I haven't sold it, I've got it here. Mum. And it has been meaningful because I've been in the UK for 10 years and the suitcase and the ring have kind of grown and changed with me. So it's as if I've always got them with me.
And is the ring some sort of protection that you could sell perhaps if things got difficult?
Yes, it's only come to ponder that once, but as I said, still here, I bounced back.
Okay. So that the chapter in the book that refers to what we're talking about now is called The Grip. And The Grip is a Jamaican or Caribbean word, and it's an English word, obviously, for a suitcase. And every household that I went to when I grew up in the capital of Britain, a place called Luton, they all had these grips. I don't know why you're laughing. They all had these grips on top of the wardrobe. And they were there. And they were there because there was a possibility that you might need to get back your clothes and your items and go put them in the grip and return to where you came from, just in case people like Enoch Powell had their way. In 1968, Enoch Powell, you will remember, some of you who are old enough, that he wrote a speech which became known as the Rivers of Blood speech, where he worried that there were too many migrants, that the black man was going to have the whip hand over the white man, so it's time for them to pack their bags and go. But we haven't gone, and we're here to stay. I should point out that I'm wearing this lovely gown, which is a wrap that has been given to me by Eric's mother. And I'm really pleased that if I ever leave Britain, I'm going to carry this with me to the next. So Eric, how about you? What did you bring from Cameroon?
I didn't bring a luggage. I didn't bring a ring. I brought one particular memory. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at the airport, you know, my mother was there, but she did not speak with me. You know, my cousins, my nephews, they were all at the airport. And my mother walked towards me without actually looking at me. But then when I looked at her, I noticed that my mother was crying. And my mother then took my hands into her hands. And one by one, she gave each of my fingers a gentle bite. I did not have a clue what my mother was doing, because until that moment, everybody knew I was going to Belgium. You know, but as it turned out, I never got to Brussels. I ended up in Russia. But the significance of this moment is something that has always stayed with me, because my mother biting my fingers, she was entering into an agreement between her, my ancestors, and myself, that wherever I go, whatever troubles I might face, I will come back to her in Cameroon while she was still alive, and not while she was walking within the passages of her grave. Yeah, so that is that memory that I brought with me.
Thank you, Eric. And Suzanne from Ireland.
Well, I came over in 1987, and Ireland now has got quite a lot of cultural cachet, but back then it really didn't. So I was a sort of cultural refugee, and I brought a letter with me from a psychiatrist, because Ireland had literally driven me mad in the 80s. And I bought a bag with some clothes and two books and this letter saying, to whom it may concern, this woman has just discharged herself from psychiatric care in Ireland. We strongly advised her not to do this move to UK, but now that she has, could you please take up her treatment again? So I thought I'll be fine, you know, and I found a place to live, and I got myself sorted, and I got a job doing the thing I wanted to do, which was working in Kensington Market, because I thought that was cool. And found the GP, and the GP read the letter, and they sent me to the hospital for an assessment, and they sent me off with a prescription for Valium. That was my mental health treatment, which I threw in the bin, and I was fine in the end. But yeah, it wasn't anything like a talisman or rosary beads or my granny's recipe for soda bread. It was none of that. It was completely different. Mm. But yeah,
there are lots of lovely stories in the book. One of my favorite is about what a Serb would bring, and for some reason there are many Serbs in the book, and one of them told me that the thing that was most precious to a Serb when they left their home to come to a foreign land was their manual coffee grinder. And sometimes they're very ornate objects, but their actual act of grinding the coffee reminds them of home, reminds them of ceremony, reminds them of family. And I think sometimes we forget the kind of emotional cost of migration, and the courage it takes to leave your friends and relations behind. Sometimes it takes a lot of courage to remain behind as well. Sometimes we forget that. One of the themes we wanted to explore in the book also was this idea about when you feel that you are becoming British. At what point in your life, when you're in Britain, do you begin to maybe lose a sense of your identity being firmly established with your country of origin, but moving towards the country that you now have adopted? And there's at least a couple of Cameroons in the book, one of whom is Clementine Burnley, who, when she was 17, went from Cameroon to Glasgow to study at university, and she had been brought up in a compound where everybody was very sociable, and she was trained and schooled never to ignore anybody. So she was very, very talkative and loved welcoming and conversing with people. I don't know whether you've ever been to Glasgow, but she would walk down Byers Road, which is not a very long road, maybe half a mile, 3/4 mile, if that. So it should take you maybe half an hour to go down Byers Road. It took Clementine 4 hours to go down, because she would stop and talk to everybody. And she said that she realized that she was becoming British when it only took her 15 minutes to walk down Byers Road. Amanda, when did you begin to feel the shift from Puerto Rico to being British? Oh, do you feel British?
I was having this conversation last night, actually. When I first moved to the UK, I think I probably felt a bit more American. It's funny, when you're bilingual, you sort of think you have these two opposing personalities and what kind of comes up every time. And I recently visited the United States and came back. I was like, oh, I think I've been in the UK so long. There was just something about the way people treated you and talked to you that I've just completely gotten used to, the tone and sorry and hello and excuse me, which is interesting. However, I find that I need a space where I can be just completely Puerto Rican-ish, I guess. And I've sort of housed a bunch of friends, Latin American friends who like salsa music, and we recreate that. And thankfully, I've now gotten married to a very nice man who makes me plantain and rice and beans and all that sort of thing, because you just always need a bit of that. My mood will change and I'll think, what's up? And then I'll have some plantain and I'll feel a bit better, because there is something about you that you need to connect with all the time. And I don't know if I feel British, but I'm definitely British-like.
Oh,
I'd
maybe
say.
British adjacent.
Yeah, sort of a British flavor, I'd say. Yeah.
Eric.
I don't think British as such. But we are in Wales, right? So I should have started this conversation with Eric Dui, Dwin Dot or Cameroon and Ridiol, on Dwin Bour and Kaidade. That is as far as I can go. Dwin Hoffi Triok, Sharaik, Kamraik. So I could feel I'm becoming Welsh, but not British as such. But my daughter is British. But something strange happened. You know, I try to repeat the same thing that my mom did to me in 1997 at the airport. My daughter was 16 at the time, and this was the first time that I was preparing to go back to Cameroon. So I called my daughter, Ia. She came and she was sitting with me. She said, Dad, you are behaving a bit strange. So I said, okay, can you give me a hand, please? She's 16 years old, so she gave me a hand. So I bit her baby finger. She looked at me suspiciously. I bit her ring finger, she started giggling. And then she goes, oh, Dad, you don't have to be so dramatic, right? I'm going to remember you. She doesn't realize I was trying to pass to her ancestral knowledge. She was like, Dad.
We're good.
Yeah, we are good. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And Suzanne?
I don't... It's funny, I kind of feel like I've straddled the two places. I've spent one third of my life in Ireland and two thirds in the UK and beyond. And I feel the older I get, the more Irish I feel, because Ireland has changed so much now that I'm proud to be Irish. I want to belong to Ireland, mm-hmm. but from a distance. I don't want to go back there. Mm. But it's like cracking a code. So when I get a taxi in Ireland, they'll say to me, what part of England are you from? Mm. Which is kind of weird. But here, nobody would mistake me for being an English person, you know. Mm. So it's like kind of having a dual code inside your head, and you slot. Like when I'm in Ireland, I slot straight away. Mm. But I do, the thing that you just said about the woman walking down the street and it taking, I notice I've definitely become, I have over the years become a lot less inclined to chit-chat and a lot more kind of brisk, definitely. Yeah. And I think that might be a London thing rather than an English thing.
So I grew up in Luton in a Caribbean household, and whenever I was a kid and people asked me where I was from, I had a nice little, I thought, intelligent phrase which I'd rehearsed. And I would say, I'm British by birth, but Jamaican by will and inclination. And if ever my father, who was called Bad Guy, because he had these permanent bangs under his eyes, was called Bad Guy, but if ever Clinton George, Bad Guy Grant, heard me say that, he'd say, stop that tripe! You're born right here! You are English! I am British, now let's get that straight. Don't let the man take you for fool. But I still hold on to this notion that I was kind of Jamaican, or Jamaican adjacent, because I always loved the way that my father walked. My father was a Jamaican, as was my mother, and my father had a walk like this, which was just faster than slow. And so I tried to emulate my father's walk, and when I was 19, I went to Jamaica for the first time by myself, and I went to the capital, and I was staying at a bed and breakfast place, and every morning I'd walk to the Bendan Market. They call it Bendan Supermarket. It's like the Bendan, where all the produce is on the ground on mats. And every time I went to the market, there would be a higgler, it's like a street seller, who'd shout at me, hey, Englishman, Englishman, Englishman. And I tried to ignore him, but then he was talking to me. And after about a week, I said to him, well, what makes you think I'm English? And he says, you walk like an Englishman. Can I just, before we move on to, we have a kind of musical component coming soon, but before we move on to the music, can I get a sense from you all about what perception you had of Britain before you came here and what informed that perception? And then the third part is did the perception live up to the reality?
You go.
Well, yeah, I think, I don't know. Obviously, Puerto Rico looks to America a lot, to the United States a lot. So my perception of the UK has everything to do with Jane Austen novels and romances, princes that, you know, I'd find a prince that would, I don't know, that sort of thing. And like North London, very North London, white sort of Britain, really, which is what I expected. And then I arrived and I now live in Peckham, Southeast London. And I absolutely love it. And I love the absolute variety of years and years of variety and change and waves of migration that have come through the United Kingdom, London particularly, and have met some incredibly interesting people that live in the spaces in between what whatever English or British identity is. So my favorite places are the places I didn't know existed and now I find beautiful and inspiring and amazing. So it was different, but I think it's lived up to some really lovely, lovely things that I know about you too.
Lovely. Yeah. Eric, how about you? What was your perception and how did it change?
I had no perception of the United Kingdom, let alone Wales. coming to Wales or coming to the UK was never part of my plan. But I grew up studying English literature. So when I came to Wales, I started identifying myself with some of those writers. So I met Graham Davies, I met Mena Elvin, and these are the first people who prepared me to settling in Wales. And then in 2000, I was invited to a place called Greganog. Greganog was so beautiful that it kind of looked like my grandfather's compound. That's what I said, oh, maybe I'm not far away from home. Maybe, maybe I'm home. And there's a wonderful thing that is very common among us, the Welsh people. We have this tradition where when you meet a stranger for the first time, you are obligated to tell them stories for 3 nights and 3 days. And once those 3 nights and 3 days have expired, then they'll have to reciprocate by telling you stories for 3 days and 3 nights. And then beyond that, they can say, hey, Colin, Oble Oitin Dot and Ridiol, which means, Colin, where are you from originally? The idea being, by the time we've spent this amount of energy telling each other a story, the question of where you are from becomes, it's neither here nor there. You become friends. And that is what I've learned about being in Wales, and my Welshness is about storytelling. And I mean, my friend Teresa is here. She's a wonderful storyteller, and she can tell you more about Wales and Welshness. So, yeah.
Thank you. And Suzanne, you came because what idea did you have of London, England, when you were in an island?
I had John Peel coming through the radio, and I had Smash Hits, Jackie Magazine. Bearing in mind in Ireland, everything was completely illegal when I was growing up. So the Face, the magazines were basically the thing that got, and I just thought, this place sounds like a mythical utopia, you know. And the Enemy gig guide was another huge thing. It was just like seeing the music, that the bands that you could go and see every night. And my parent and my grandmother and my mother used to describe England as that godless country, which was hugely appealing. I was so sick of God. honestly, I was so sick of the whole God thing. So coming here and the anonymity. My picture of London was this vast, it was much more vast in real life than I could imagine, because I'm from a smallish town. But the anonymity, the fact that you could drop dead in the street and somebody would step over you, that was all really appealing. Because I was just sick of small town life and God. Yeah. So, and London really delivered, really delivered.
Well, that brings me on to another thought I'm just having. I'm going to start with you, we're going to go around this way this time. Is where you move to, and do you move to where your people are? So did you move to an area where there are lots of Irish people, lots of Cameroon people, lots of people from Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, not Costa Rica. So what's the appeal of Ireland in the personification of Irish people more attractive to you when they were in the UK?
No, I didn't want to be anywhere near anything to do with Ireland, apart from a handful of friends who felt the same. And I did, my initial friends when I came here were Irish, but we were all on the same boat, literally. We were escaping, and we wanted to meet people who were not Irish, who didn't think like Irish, you know, we wanted to get away from, because we grew up in a monoculture, monotheistic monoculture. So we were just desperate to immerse ourselves in the big, big, you know, heathen city. And we did, and it was just fantastic. But there was, obviously, there was big Irish community, and I first lived in North London. And there was, you know, the Archway Tavern down the road, where the builders would go in and cash their, get paid in pints, kind of. It was all that, and there was ballrooms and dance halls. I couldn't have gotten further away from that, if I, you know, it was just not of any interest.
Well, that really resonates with me, because my father, as I've mentioned, was from Jamaica. And Jamaica, you may know, is a pigmentocracy. And by that, I mean the fairer skin you have, the better. And so the people with the dark skin are at the bottom of society, and they can't ascend. And they always are given the rough ride in life. But when a lot of the Caribbean people came, no matter what level of the pigmentocracy they were in the Caribbean, in England, they were just black, as far as people know. People didn't make any kind of nuance between the different shades of black. And so I grew up in a Irish estate in Luton. All my friends were Flynns, O'Loughlins, Duns, O'Hearns, Glynns, O'Learys. And I think when my father came to Luton and to the UK, it was like having a blank canvas. He could start again. Nobody knew where he was supposed to fit in the social tier. Until one day, we were on this council estate in Luton. There are 1,500 families on this council estate in Luton. There are several hundred Irish families. There's six Caribbean families scattered around this huge estate. And then one day, the council, in their wisdom, decided to put another Caribbean family right next door. And I'll never forget, my father's a bit of a rascal. My father summons the children to the window to observe these people coming in as they're unloading the van to their new house. And he says, "Imagine this. I travel 4,000 miles to get away from these people, and who do they put next door?" And that's one of the kind of interesting conundrums of the book and the project, that sometimes the people from Cameroon or from Puerto Rico don't want to associate themselves with each other when they get here. How did you find that experience?
To be honest with you, I wasn't looking for any Cameroonian community. When I came to Wales, I was looking for an individual. Because I had, in the summer of 1998 in Russia, I had a horrible experience with a group of Cameroonians took me hostage. I was guilty of the crime. They took me hostage, and for 3 days and three nights, they tortured me to the point of death. In fact, I prayed for death to embrace me. But something strange happened that time, because my mother came to me. She came to me through a song. Agbewolo atimbangundu, agbewolo e atimbangundu he. Weye oma weya weya nje he, weya oma mo kakang mema. It's about a woman who's lamenting the death of her children. But my mother changed the lyrics this time around. She was telling me that if I allow these guys to kill me and bury me, she'll come to Russia, dig me out of my shallow grave, and kill me again. So I was so frightened of what my mom would do to me. I survived the torture from those people. So when I came to Wales in July of 1999, the last people I wanted to meet were Cameroonians, but I was looking for one guy. And in 1990, when I was 10 years old, Cameroon played against England in the World Cup. And this guy, who's one of the best mathematicians in Wales at the moment, Olivier, came to Cameroon. And he invited, Olivier, you're from the white man's land, the land of milk and honey. You know, he was telling us, guess where I watched the 1990 football game? I watched it in an amphitheater at Cardiff University. Yeah, so that was my motivation coming to Cardiff. I was looking for this one Cameroonian. And I arrived at with the National Express in the morning, and I saw this black guy, and I walked up to him, excuse me, with my thick Cameroonian accent, right? Excuse me, do you know a Cameroonian? This guy looked at me like, and he just walked off. Yeah, but the rest is history, because I found him, yeah.
Good, thank you. And Amanda, do you associate with Latin Americans, Puerto Ricans? Is there a magnet for you?
Well, My expectation wasn't to meet any Latin Americans in the United Kingdom, and I moved first to West Hampstead, so found none. However, it's been interesting. I always say this joke. There is a group called Puerto Ricans in the United Kingdom on Facebook. There are 64 members. 34 have left. Puerto Ricans don't come to the United Kingdom. We're a very rare breed, and I didn't think I'd come across any Latinos because I had no idea about the history that there is a relationship. And then came across this beautiful place called Elephant Castle, where I met Venezuelans and Colombians and wonderful clubs and all the rest of it. But it was a complete surprise because when I first came here, one, people don't know where Puerto Rico is, don't know about its relationship with the US. So people have no expectations of me at all. I just feel, I'm from Puerto Rico. And they sort of nod, oh, great. There wasn't even a Latin American box when I moved. No, always other. And I guess in some ways, it's incredibly liberating because there's a whole history of relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico, and people all have already made up your mind about you when they meet you. And however, that doesn't happen in England, but I've explained many a time where Puerto Rico is, and I'm still not tired, actually. So if anybody doesn't know, let me know, and we can have a chat after.
Thank you. So we're going to have a bit of a musical interlude now, because one of the themes that we address in the book, there are 12 themes in the book. There's a theme about embracing the idea of becoming British. There's a theme about accepting that you are British. There's a theme about whether you want to return or not to the place of your origin. But one of the things I wanted to get from everybody is the place of music in their souls and in their journeys, in their stories of being migrants. And I start with my mother's story. And in every Caribbean household that I grew up in Luton, as you know, in every Caribbean household in Luton in the 70s, on a Sunday, my friends at the back are about to play the song that you would hear. Welcome to my world.
Welcome to my world. Won't you come on in? Miracles, I guess, still happen now and then. Step into my heart.
Yeah, and it sounds a bit counterintuitive, but a lot of the Caribbean people felt nostalgia when they heard that song. Anyway, yeah. So I asked everybody else what songs then somehow characterize their migration story, and we're going to hear a song that you've chosen now, Amanda. We're going to have Fabricando. Tell us about that song, Amanda, why you chose it.
Yes. The song is called Fabricando Fantasías, Fabricating Fantasies by Tito Nieves. And my mother's a huge salsa fan, and she is of the generation of romantic salsa of the 90s and early 2000s. And that is a song she played and played and played. And it's a beautiful song because practically it's fantastic to learn salsa too. It's got a really nice steady tempo. It's slow and beautiful, but also sounds beautiful if you don't understand the lyrics. But he's talking about the death of his son. And
wow.
How he's fabricating fantasies of seeing him again. Mm. And I've always found it, when she'd play it in the car or whatever it may be, that how could you do such a joyous and beautiful act like dancing salsa with a partner and also discuss this thing? And I've now, my memory of it is that, me, my mother in the car, and her maybe listening to that if she's missing me, I don't know. I admire my mother very much and talk about her constantly. And I taught my now husband to dance salsa to that song.
Oh, lovely.
And he played it over and over again. He's actually gotten really good for a Worcester guy. And that somehow has managed to bridge the gap a little bit, because you always feel that there's two whole elements of you that don't quite unite somehow. And I find that that song, and having shared that with two people that are very, very important to me, have kind of managed that. So that's why I chose that.
Thank you, Amanda. Yeah. So we're going to turn to Eric now, and I'm going to ask Eric to introduce the title of this song and who's by.
My song is Rukiver, Yatibiadni Adam Nikamu.
Hey, why did you choose that song?
So there's a chorus. I go, Katia Sivonia Huchitsa, Tokasta Boyoria Dambit, Sonich Katimaya Snaya, Tokatibia Adno Luve. You know, I was standing on the window on the balcony in Olitsa Gribayudova in Sochi in 1997. I was the only black person in this place. But curiously, there was this woman, her name is Chiocha Vera, and she'll be sitting by the road. And she will sell what in Russian we call salyuny ryba, which is salted fish. And she will sell damashni piva, which is homemade alcohol. And she'll be looking at me. And this song, I don't know whether she had this radio which had only this song. And Chiocha Vera will play this song until one afternoon she invited me. And she asked me where I was from. But Chiocha Vera started teaching me the Russian language. And the 1 minute she was there, and the next minute she disappeared.
Oh.
A couple of weeks later, I asked my neighbor that, where is Chiocha Vera? And he said, oh, Chiocha Vera is dead. Yeah, there were no goodbyes, no more. So this music is like associated with this memory. Again, once I started understanding the meaning of this music, I started missing my girlfriend. You know, although I was 17 when I left home, I had this girl that we had plans. When I came to Wales in July 1999, a few months later, she sent me a letter. And in the background, Rukiver was playing.
Mm.
So let me read my letter for my girlfriend from Cameroon. Oh my God. Rukiver is playing, the love music is playing in the background. And the letter said, Dear Eric, I miss you, I love you. Yesterday I went to a church and I met a pastor. So I switched off the music, because the tone of the letter changed. And she dumped me. Yeah, man.
And so you don't have that negative association with the music?
No, but I still love the music because of Chiocha Vera, but I don't think about that letter anymore.
Thank you very much, Eric. And finally, Suzanne, what song have you chosen? And we'll hear it.
It's a song by a country western singer in Ireland called Gloria, and it was number one in Ireland for about 90 weeks when I was a teenager.
And it's called?
One Day at a Time, Sweet Jesus.
So I was expecting you to say The Smiths or something, but Gloria. Why Gloria?
Well, because she helped me to get out of Ireland.
Oh.
I mean, 90 weeks of number one. You know. She was part of the impetus to leave. Although the first gig I ever saw in Ireland was The Smiths when I was 15, but it was so rare that a good band came to Cork, which is where I'm from, that if you wanted to see any proper music, you had to go to Dublin or London, and I didn't want to go to Dublin because it's just more of the same.
Yeah.
Just they look down on you in Dublin if you're from Cork.
Yeah.
So I thought if I go to London, I won't know any, you know, it'll be just again blank slate like your dad.
Yeah.
And now we have Kneecap. At 90 weeks.
Wow.
They're at number one now rather than Gloria. So yeah. Ireland has changed radically for the better.
Thank you. Well, let's open up to the floor. If there's anybody who'd like to ask any member of the panel or a question about migration at this pivotal moment in our culture, especially, we'd love to hear from you. Anybody want to pose a question? Can't see anybody. Oh, yes, please.
I stand up because you'll see me. Oh. I just wondered, you know, my mum left Ireland a long time before you. She came in the 50s. And having lived here for nearly 50 years, she needed a passport because she was actually going away, you know, over board. We only ever went back to Ireland. Mum hadn't been anywhere other than London, Cornwall and Ireland. And, you know, when she applied for her passport, having lived in London for 50 years, she was absolutely horrified when this British subject passport arrived. And she was like, I'm not using that ever. And ironically, then she applied for the Irish passport, and that's what she travelled on. And I just wondered whether anybody else had that experience. Maybe your parents from Jamaica did. But my mum started to feel British, maybe, you know, because you've been married to a Scottish person and had three children. And she started to feel British, although, just like your experiences, that no one would ever think she was English when you hear her talk. But she absolutely hated the concept of being referred to as a British subject. And I just wondered if anyone else had anything along those lines in their journey.
Well, one interesting thing about the Caribbean people who came famously, allegedly, in 1948, but they came before the Windrush, was that they came and the way that they were described changed over the passage of time. So when my parents arrived, they were British citizens. And after a while, they became citizens of the Commonwealth and Empire. And then they were bloody foreigners. And so my mother never really felt at home here, and would tell you that she didn't have many, many happy occasions. And what she did, and maybe that's why I write about migrants now, she disassociated herself with all of the migrants in Luton. So all of her friends were Irish friends. And what was intriguing to me was to listen to their grievances. So we used to have a game when I was growing up in Luton. We would have a game about who'd been done worse to by the English. And we'd say, yeah, man, the English, you've been under the heel of the English for 400 years, man, 400 years in slavery. And my Irish friends said, that's nothing. We've been under the heel of the English for 800 years and before. So it led to this notion that maybe one should return, which we talk about in the book, actually. So my mother never really accepted the notion that she was British, because she didn't feel very welcome, ultimately. What about other people?
I have never had that experience. It took the Home Office about 10 years to accept the fact that I was not a Zimbabwean, that I'm a Cameroonian. Now that I'm a Cameroonian, I don't think I would apply for British citizenship. However, if the Plaid Cymru decides that they're going to break up the United Kingdom and they issue me a passport, I'll take it. Yes, I'm just saying. So I'm a Cameroonian. My children are Welsh, but I've not had that problem.
What about you, Amanda, and then Suzanne?
Yes, well, I've just managed indefinite leave to remain, and I think it's interesting because Puerto Ricans have an American passport. I hadn't gone through a lot of the migration processes, and from the moment I got here onwards, the cost of migrating legally to United Kingdom has doubled or tripled. The things you have to go through, the tests you have to take, and all the rest of it changed, not even for citizenship. You now need to take your citizenship test, even if I haven't applied for a passport. And I hope they don't annul indefinite leave to remain, because I'd like to stay Puerto Rican. But if I have to come up against that as a challenge, we shall see.
Thank you. And Suzanne?
Well, my Irish passport is my fondest possession because since Brexit, I've been, you know, people have been asking me to marry them and everything.
Oh, really?
But my kids are British. Hmm. They're British Asian and British Irish. So it's kind of, they feel quite a different attachment to Ireland. Than I do, but yeah, I really, really, really value my EU passport so much. I almost have it in a glass case. Wow.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the question. Any other questions? Yes, there's in the third, fourth row here. That'd be great. And then at the back later. Yeah.
Hi. I was wondering whether, since you moved to the UK, there were any other groups of migrants that you found like common ground with, or like special relationships where you feel like you can relate to them, like you were talking about with your Jamaican family and Irish migrants?
Yeah, please.
Everybody, really. Anybody who's been colonized, mm-hmm. for sure. There's that. But I suppose my experience is a bit different because you only know people are Irish when they open their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? But generally my affinity would be with anybody whose country's been occupied.
Mm. Eric?
Yeah, for me it was quite different because again, when I came here, all I had were my memories, and I used to find myself in a situation where organizations would call me and say, "Eric, can you come and stand on the stage and can you tell me how you got to Britain?" And I couldn't articulate how I got to Britain, and in fact I didn't know which memories I had to share with them. But then in 2001, I met a wonderful gentleman in Swansea, and we started what we call Havan Books, which was a publishing house which was championing voices that were in the periphery. So I was running creative writing workshops, and I heard stories that were horrendous, and I was thinking, yeah, I am feeling depressed about myself, but there are people who are... So this is how I started finding my voice. So although I live in Cardiff, people actually think I live in Swansea, because Swansea is like my hub. I go to Dylan Thomas Centre, I go to Volcano Theatre. And yeah, so from 2001, I started finding my voice. And my first poetry anthology came out in 2003, Between a Mountain and a Sea. Yeah, and that was it. Like, and I've not looked back ever since.
Yes, Amanda.
I have to say, it's mostly Latin Americans, really, of the absolute breadth of Latin America, and we are very different. Being kind of put together in one big box. Oh, you're all Latinos. You've realized that we've shared so many different customs and music and food, and that I had no idea of before I moved here. So actually, it's been a really amazing opportunity to know a lot more about Latin America that I probably wouldn't have if I hadn't moved to London.
One of the things that happened in the 1990s was that there's a man called Norman Tebbit. You may remember him. Mm-hmm. Died recently. I had a bit of fond regard for Norman Tebbit in a funny way. That's because he's a bit of a Rottweiler, but I kind of admired him for being a Rottweiler. But he had this test about whether you were truly British or English when it came to cricket. So when England were playing against someone from Pakistan or India or the West Indies, who do you cheer for? And so we would cheer for the West Indies, only because they were kind of glamorous anyway, and they were fearless, and they were better than the English. But a funny thing happened in 1980. I'll never forget this, because I think we as Caribbean people, well, I'm from Luton, but anyway, kind of Caribbean origin people, began to look for people who had that kind of similar sensibility. And so when it came to athletics, we were not going to support Sebastian Coe. Steve Avett was our man because of his sensibility. And when it came to the Olympics in 1980, a phenomenon happened in our household, because any sporting event that had black people, we would cheer for the black person. But in the 1980 Olympics, in the 100 meters, there was a man called Alan Wells from Scotland, and he was lined up against some black Caribbean people, and we cheered for Alan Wells because we just loved his personality. And we loved the fact he was Scottish and not English as well, I suppose. But that posited the idea that actually that your allegiance is not necessarily to your phenotype or your group, but to a similar sensibility, perhaps.
Mm.
Yeah. Let me ask a question. Thank you. Another question?
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. It's really lovely to hear you talk. Eric, I'm a huge fan of your poetry, Diolch o Galon. Could you share a little bit about the writers who inspire you, whether they're from your countries of origin or writers today in the UK?
Okay. One of my favorite Welsh writers, and I'm being brutally honest here, is Graham Davies. I met Graham in 1999, and Graham introduced me to his poem, and the poem is called Rough Guide. I think it's one of the most translated Welsh poems. And in this poem, the character finds themselves in America, and in some places they are referred to as Navajo, in some places they are referred to as Cajun, in some places they are referred to as Black. But this character was looking for some place where they could just go and just be. So the title of this poem is Rough Guide. And when I came to it, I just wanted somewhere where I could just go and be without answering to anyone. So this is my first poem. And then the second one is Conflict in Abiquiu. This poem was written in the 5th century. It's at the National Library of Wales. And then the third stanza of the poem goes, noisy the birds, damn the valleys, long the night was rare its praise, and I deserve the reward of age, sleep. When I came to Wales, I was absolutely naked. Can I use the word naked?
Yeah, please, you have done.
All I wanted to do was to sleep. And so that was the two poems. The contemporary, I love the poetry of Mena Elvin, I love the poetry of Ryan Elizabeth, I love the poetry of Natalie Ann Holborough, but I made the horrible mistake. In June last year, I reviewed Natalie's book, and Natalie's book is set in a hospital. And the following day, I had a horrible medical incident, and I found myself at the emergency ward. And everything that I read in Natalie's book was happening. The drip machines were going click, 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 click. My neighbor was entering into a coughing fit. I'm like, flipping neck. I'm a goner. I recommend Natalie Ann Holborough's book. It's wonderful.
Amanda.
Wow, quite a breadth of people. A lot of people I've read in Writers, I've met in Writers Mosaic, reviewed books, etc., people I would have read before. As a classic Latin American, I absolutely love Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I think his short stories, his long books are absolutely amazing. And interestingly, in the thing that I'm writing and working on now, I've gone back to a lot of Puerto Rican writers that I think when I was studying in Puerto Rico, I didn't appreciate because I was looking elsewhere. I was looking at the United Kingdom, mostly, I have to say. So Luis Llorens Torres is someone everybody should know, a name you should know and you should look up, because actually a wonderful man from a very local space that talks about huge themes that I think could connect with everyone. And being far away has made me give new appreciation to that.
Thank you. Suzanne.
Writers I like from, it's really hard to answer that one, but because there's so many, and there's a whole crop of new Irish writers that are coming, that have come up in recent years, that are really fresh and vibrant, and I can't at all think of one single name because I've just gone blank. Yeah. But there's so many. There's the classic ones as well, obviously, like Colm Tobin and stuff, but yeah, the new ones, the new voices, and Claire
Keegan. I was going to mention, I'm glad I got to say Claire Keegan, because I was going to say Claire Keegan.
Yeah, she's
Small Things Like These.
Yeah,
she's a fantastic writer. And that really inspires me to think that actually we find our people, no matter where they are, they don't have to be Cameroonian or Jamaican, they can be Irish, they can be Puerto Rican, if they speak to us in a certain way. Mm. One final question then at the back. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing all these stories. I had a lot of feelings with that salsa song. I'm Colombian, and my husband is British. I was wondering, I have been trying to teach him to dance salsa for the last 4 years. And after a while, we keep having a lot of cultural shocks, like very interesting. And I was wondering if you have some stories, if you have a British couple,
then
you can share some interesting.
His parents were here, actually, so that'd be good. Wow, Oliver Hamilton, yes. I have to say, I explained to him where Puerto Rico was pretty straight off the bat when we met. And I'll never forget having, I think I wasn't sure if he was interested or not, because the signs weren't the same as in Latin America. We'd been dating for about 6 months, and I turned to him and went, do you like me? Because, you know, it wasn't super, and he turned bright red and went, oh yes, of course, of course, of course. Because there was a lot, you know, wouldn't text back, and you sort of give me my space at the weekend, which I like now. But at the time, we're in exactly the cues that you're following, so I don't know if that's happened to you. And with salsa, I suppose, we met at drum school, and we all had to learn merengue in the classroom. The teacher taught, you know, loose hips or whatever, had to dance with everyone. And then suddenly we're both like this, and it locked his hips, and he was, oh, natural, natural movement. It's like, oh, that's tick. So after that, back and forth, he got really well. It's the hips I'd concentrate on.
Very good, yeah. Well, thank you. That's a lovely way to draw to the close. I'd like to commend everybody who's been on the stage, and to say that you can find Eric's book at the bookshop. It's called Homelands. But you check out this site called Google, and you could look for Suzanne's book, Suzanne Harrington's book. All of the people on the stage are in the book, What We Leave We Carry, I almost forgot the title, and there are some books available. And I'd just like to point out that there is a great emotional cost to migration. And my mother used to say, I must have my cry occasionally. So I was crying for my mother. So thank you for the applause. And shall we end with another version of Welcome to My World? Thank you very much for coming.
Just for you. Welcome.